welcome to the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. This is episode 45. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined by the ever-astute Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry?
Good, thank you, David. Good to be back in the wilds of Melbourne after a week driving around Victoria, doing the right thing by spending my money in the regional areas.
Oh, have you been asked? I haven't been out at all, but there you go.
Oh, yeah, well, it's been a lot of rain, so I can understand why you wouldn't be. 42 degrees one day, 2 days later, it was absolutely belting down.
Yeah.
Rain's coming in sideways, pretty much, but strange times.
Strange times indeed.
So strange times also, David, for a few things happening in the SF world at the moment.
We've got the Hugos, is that right?
Yeah, the Hugos, and also this year's World Science Fiction Convention. There'd been a... Well, the World Science Fiction Convention this year is being held in Washington, D.C. They were originally intending to have a virtual convention along the lines of Con New Zealand for 2020. But they have started negotiations with the venues to see whether it would be possible to have an in-person convention in December.
Yeah.
Now, they had put out a survey to a whole lot of people around to their members sometime in January, and they had hoped to be allowed to be able to announce over this past weekend what the decision was. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to do that. What seems to have happened is one of their preferred venues, hotel venues, has gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
Well, has filed for bankruptcy and is closing down. And they have a claim against it. So there's a lot of legal action going. Yeah, so they can't say what they can do. This is what happens when you get into the real world with science fiction conventions.
Yeah,
and you get
yeah.
really big and you suddenly find that the real world does intrude, unfortunately. So we haven't quite heard what's happening with that yet. However, we do know that the Hugo Award nominations have now opened. They generally do sometime in the middle of January, and they run through until, I'm not sure, maybe end of May, end of April. I'm not terribly sure. I can find the full details out about that. I should have done that before I came on, but that just goes to show you that too many other things going on and you forget about it.
Yeah.
So if you are a past member of Con New Zealand, you're allowed to nominate. And if you were a member of, or if you became a member of this year's WorldCon on or prior to December 31, 2020, you're also allowed to nominate.
Okay.
So that means that I can, because I'm in a supporting member because I voted in the ballot. Another long detailed story about how you become a supporting member, but it's the cheapest way to do it, which we'll talk about again when we get closer to the this year's WorldCon.
Yep.
So anyway, I'll be able to nominate. Voting will be allowed for only those members of this year's World Science Fiction Convention, either supporting or attending.
Yep.
And we'll give some details out about that when that turns up. And you can't vote on anything until the nomination period's over. They calculate all the nominations, work out the six entries on each category, for each category on the ballot, and then make it available. And then we'll be talking about that ad infinitum. Well, at least I will be, because I'll probably still be going through that habit of trying to read it all.
Well, yeah, I don't think I will, but we'll see.
Trying to get through it all. Trying to get rid of it, probably. This year's not as... I think you might recall last year, there was... I had a couple of books which I was pretty certain were going to be on the list. So I read them early, and they were fine. Not so sure this year, but there might just be one I talk about today. But anyway, so that's all I wanted to basically say about that sort of stuff. So
indeed.
We just carry on now, David. You're in charge this week.
Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, no problems.
Well, before we leave the Hugos, it's probably just worth mentioning, I would have thought, that, you know, this little podcast itself is eligible for the best fan cast category.
It is, actually.
You could actually nominate us. You know, our listener could nominate us.
Our listener could nominate us.
So if they were, it's worth thinking about.
Yeah.
It's worth thinking about.
I wonder, is it Is it sort of prefix rules that you're not supposed to vote for yourself or nominate yourself?
I think we can probably nominate ourselves. We're probably the only two votes.
That'll probably be it. But there we go. You never know. We might get there. Yeah, there we are. It's all fun.
So this episode we're going back to talking about just what we've been reading lately, and I've certainly been reading quite a lot since the beginning of the year, and indeed since the last episode. So I'm just picking a few things that I'm going to talk about. Otherwise, we'd be here all day. And the first one I thought I'd talk about is an unusual one, which is a book called Clarissa Harlow by Samuel Richardson. Now, I don't know whether you know about this book, but this was actually written in 1748, or published in 1748, and was written by Richardson over a period of several years. Now, it's an interesting book. It's the subtitle is, so it's Clarissa Harlow, or The History of a Young Lady. And it's one of the longest novels ever written in the English language. It's we did a count of it being 940,000 words. I've been doing this particular book for Standard eBooks, and which we have talked about a few times on the podcast, where we take works which are in the public domain and clean them up and make them look really nice and put them out as free eBooks. And so I'm working off an edition which was transcribed by Project Gutenberg, and they based their transcription on an edition that was printed in 1902 in 9 volumes.
Count them, nine volumes. Oh my God.
And what's more, the whole thing is entirely in the form of letters from several people to other people. Now, it may all seem very daunting, but it's actually a very good read. It's really, really good read. And it's highly regarded and considered one of the great classics of English literature. And it often appears on those lists of, you know, The Guardian best novels ever written, 100 best novels ever written, that sort of thing. So I won't go into any great detail about it, but to say that we're doing it for Standard eBooks, and it's not actually available just yet, but it will be in a couple of weeks. So it basically is the story of young Clarissa Harlow, who's 18 at the start of the novel. She's sort of generally regarded by everyone around her as being the most virtuous and kind young woman that they know. However, she makes a mistake in trying to reconcile a dispute between her very rash brother and this chap called Richard Lovelace, who's a well-born, rich young man who's regarded generally as a bit of a rake. And so she's drawn into correspondence with the latter, trying to mediate this dispute. Now, Lovelace, so many things in this relate to current relations between men and women, I think, or, you know, young men and young women. Because Lovelace, because she tries to do this mediation, thinks that this indicates that she's got the hots for him, whereas in fact she hasn't. But thinking that she's got the hots for him, he starts to carry out all this very complex series of plots and plans and stratagems and inventions which eventually result in him abducting her from her family, at which point she's rejected and totally estranged from her family, but she's in the grasp of this bloke who's a real rake. So a lot of the correspondence is between Clarissa and her close friend, and then there's all this other correspondence which is between Lovelace and his friend Jack Belford, to whom he confesses all of these stratagems that he's carrying out in his assault on Clarissa's honour. So it's really a fascinating study of human nature, and so much of it is really relevant today, I think, in terms of all these techniques of gaslighting and men trying to control women and having a mistaken idea whether the women actually are interested in them or not. It's very, very relevant, I think. So it's a great book. So that's the first one I wanted to talk about.
Sounds like a riveting read of 900,000 words.
Well, the fact of the matter is that because I've been working on it for Standard eBooks, and that means that I've had to format each letter as we go, you know, the proper sort of heading of the letter and the things being marked as the salutation, the things being marked as the valediction and the footnotes and the postscripts and all that sort of stuff has to be formatted. Oh, the other thing is footnotes. There's something like 450 footnotes, which all had to be formatted. So it's actually taken me nearly 3 years. So I've been reading this book for 3 years.
Well, it's good to get through a large project like that and sort of basically come to the end of it. Well, so you've done a very good job on that.
Yeah.
at our recent drinks with our old friend and probably listener to the podcast, Gary Hanfield, who was saying that he's just read a new space opera, which he thought was absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
He said, it is a bit of a problem. It's 800 pages. And I'm like, oh, God.
That's nothing.
I groaned at that, and I thought, well, in comparison to what you've just been through, that's a mere bag of hell.
No,
you just throw it out, no problem. Read it in a couple of hours, piece of cake.
I do have to say, I don't think I'm going to be going back and rereading it in a hurry.
No, I think you've probably done your dash. You know, if we're looking at that, being at that age, David, where you're not going to get back to too many books, not much chance of getting back to too many books in the future, that's probably one that you can just say, no, I've done that, been there, done that, not doing it again.
Indeed. Okay, so what have you been reading?
Well, the one that I've got that I wanted to have a talk about, even though I picked it as one of my best books of last year, because it came in so late in the year, I didn't actually have a chance to talk about it. And it's The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. Now, actually, I do go back and re-listen to things, David, and I do go back and look over what I've read and or written and the notes I've taken. And I have a feeling I may have been calling this The Ministry of the Future. Naughty me.
No,
it's The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. Now, Stan Robinson was, as you all know, the guest of honour at the 2010 World Science Fiction Convention we had here in Melbourne, of which I was co-chair. And we were very happy to have him here. And he's produced some phenomenal books. And I know you're not a big fan, but you know, I reckon you might.
This one looks interesting.
Once I get through this, and Todd, tell you about this one, I think you might give this one a bit of a try.
Yeah.
He's produced some fairly fantastic books in the last 10 years or so. And you almost get to the point that you feel like he's at pretty much the height of his powers. He's really got it all together. He's been considered by a lot of people around the world to be the major, well, not necessarily in the field, because his sort of style and who he is and what he writes about has sort of shifted away from what a lot of people are looking at in the field recently. But for people that are outside the field and looking in, they see him as being one of the major novelists within the field. In fact, one of the major novelists in literature all told.
Sure.
Now, this is a book that is 560-odd pages, which sounds like a heck of a brick, but really, I sat down and I reckon I ploughed through this in about 3 days. There's a lot of white space in this. There's 106 chapters. It follows a couple of main characters through their particular story, which they start off separately, interweave, and then come back again and then interweave again and join up at the end. But there's a whole lot of little snippets of things that go through. Your favourite sort of info dumps, if you like, David, the ones that you absolutely hate about Stan Robinson. But he tells it in a slightly different way this time, which you might find rather interesting. And I'm going to read one of them. It's quite short.
Sure.
It's actually the second chapter in the book. And it reads, "I am a god and I am not a god. Either way, you are my creatures. I keep you alive. Inside, I am hot beyond all telling, and yet my outside is even hotter. At my touch, you burn, though I spin outside the sky. As I breathe my big, slow breaths, you freeze and burn, freeze and burn. Someday, I will eat you. For now, I feed you. Beware my regard. Never look at me." So you can figure out pretty much what that is. He basically he writes a lot of these interlineated short chapters, which are applicable to the rest of the novel, but he writes them in that sort of old ancient riddle style, you know, like the ones that go, what walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, and three in the evening? Well, it's man. And in this instance, of course, what he's talking about is the sun.
Yeah.
And this comes directly after the very first opening chapter of this particular book, which is fairly horrific and fairly harrowing. It tells the story of a massive heat wave in the plains of India, where the wet bulb temperature gets up to 38 degrees C. Now, the wet bulb temperature is a measure of heat and humidity combined. And so 38 degrees for the wet bulb temperature, it relates to somewhere about 42 and a half degrees Celsius and about 60% humidity. That's only been achieved maybe a dozen times around the world ever. It has happened in Australia. It's happened in the UAE, Pakistan and India before, but only for short periods of time, only for like half an hour or an hour. Here he postulates in the year 2025 where it hits this particular temperature for 1 or 2 days. What ends up happening is that nobody goes out because it's just far too hot and far too humid. And it gets to the point where basically the power goes out. So this guy, Frank May, who features all the way through the book, he's one of the two big major characters. He's a North American volunteer working for a non-government organization. He invites a whole lot of people from the neighborhood into the offices for this NGO because he's got an air conditioner and he's got a generator. But because nobody's moving outside, the generator makes a lot of noise. And after a while, the local thugs come in and steal everything, the air conditioner and the generator at gunpoint, take off with it. After a while, the office starts getting in stiflingly hot. And so everybody decides to go to the local lake and they want to go there and cool down. Most of them get into the lake to try and cool down because they think it's going to be cooler. But it's been so hot for so long that the actual lake temperature starts rising and gets above body temperature. So the people in the lake start poaching from the inside out. He's sitting out trying to get a bit of shade in the sun, out on the side, and he basically goes unconscious. He wakes up sometime next day and everybody is dead. The whole of the lake is completely filled with bodies, and he's only discovered by a rescue team that's come in to actually clear the bodies out because they don't want it to sort of stink all over the place. And he's rescued. And then that basically impacts his life all the way right through. He then later on gets into contact with Mary, and I can't remember her last name for the life of me, which is always the way with these things. You sort of think you're going to remember it, but I can't. Who's the head of the Ministry for the Future, which is the United Nations organization, who are tasked with coming up with ideas for how to solve problems about what's going to be happening in the future. A bit like the privately created Commission for the Future, which was created in Australia with Philip Adams and Barry Jones back in the late 80s, who were talking then 30 odd years ago about climate change. And of course, nobody would listen to them, and they still don't listen to them. This idea about the Ministry for the Future here is where the United Nations have set this place up with the understanding that they're just going to ignore them, pretty much. Not talk to them, just have something to do. But Mary and her group become very, very pushy and start making a lot of inroads into people and start offering things that people go, actually, we can actually make money out of this. And then people around the world start looking at, well, maybe if we were able to slow the rate that the glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica are sliding into the ocean, maybe we can stop the sea level rise. This is a big, big book. It's got a lot of ideas. He's basically worked his way, Robinson this is, has worked his way through all of the processes that he can see that you take what's currently available in terms of technology and you just expand it a little bit. You don't make any big, massive changes. You reduce the size of small electronics, which is happening all the time anyway, or you beef up the number of units that you've got, which is just large manufacturing. So the book runs from around about 2025 to about 2040. You're not terribly sure exactly how long the time spans are, but it doesn't really matter. But this is a very, very important book with a lot of very interesting things in it. Some of the other, those interlineated chapters, there's one told from a point of view of a proton, a hydrogen atom, a carbon atom, history as a subject,
as a character.
The market, maybe the financial markets, is a character in this particular book. It's a stunning piece of work, but it just flows all the way right through. All the way you get a good flow of the information and you don't feel as though the info is being dumped on you in a big way, like he has done sometimes in the past.
Well, sounds good.
I think this is probably the most important science fiction book that I'm going to read that came out of 2020. I'm not sure that it will appear on any of the awards lists, because I just think that Robinson has moved to a point where he's away from what people are looking for. I hope that it picks up awards. I would expect that it's probably going to, it may appear on the Nebula Award, but I doubt that it'll appear on the Hugo. I've got fingers crossed. I'll be nominating it for the Hugo. It was my best new science fiction novel of last year, and I can only recommend it to everybody.
It does sound very good, and I've actually borrowed it from the library. I haven't started reading it yet, other than peeking into the first chapter. But so I will be reading it. And as I think I mentioned the last time we talked about it, it was on Barack Obama's list of best books of 2020. So he's got very good taste as Mr. Obama.
Yes, he does.
So it's worth looking at what he says.
It can be a tough book to read, but once you get past that first harrowing short story of about 12 pages at the beginning, which really, if he'd put out as a horror story, you could probably win awards with that one. Once you get past that, it does flow and it just takes off, and you really just don't want to stop reading it. It just keeps on going.
So that sounds great.
I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about
it. I'll be interested to read it.
I will be talking to one of our correspondents regarding this at some time coming up.
Excellent. Well, as I said, that book is on was on Barack Obama's list, and the book I'm about to talk about was also on the list. So we're having a bit of a theme here. This was The Glass Hotel by Emily St. John Mandel. Now, she is a Canadian writer, and listeners may remember her for her post-apocalyptic, post-pandemic novel Station 11, published in 2014, which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in 2015. And this appears to be her first novel since then, so she's had a bit of a gap. But it's neither science fiction nor fantasy, but it's a strictly realistic novel. Although I suppose you could argue that there are some slightly fantastic touches towards the end in the form of ghosts, or at least imagined ghosts appearing to some of the characters. So that's the only sort of fantastic element to it. So I'll just try to describe it briefly. It's always hard to describe things briefly. So at the very opening of the novel, we have a brief one-page chapter which introduces us to the first-person point of view of a character called Vincent, who is in the ocean, apparently having fallen in from a ship during a storm, and is in the process of drowning. So then we switch to a third-person point of view following a young man called Paul. He gets in trouble after having given some bad drugs to a band member in a pub in Toronto, and the band member dies. So, you know, he's fleeing in case people think he's murdered him. And he seeks refuge in Vancouver with his much younger half-sister, Vincent. So here comes Vincent. Now, it turns out that Paul and Vincent were raised in a small village called Cayette, I presume that's how you pronounce it, which is at the northern tip of Vancouver Island. And the only way to reach the village is by boat, or by, you know, one of those light planes that can have floats and can land on the water. Now, it's worth noting that Vincent's mother vanished when she was young. She set out in a canoe for a trip, but never returned. And so she was left just with her father, and at which point her father farmed her out to an aunt who doesn't love her very much. And so in her teens, she becomes quite wild. And then the scene shifts 5 years later, and both Paul and Vincent are working in a new hotel, which has been built over the water a couple of kilometres out from the town of Cayette. And this is the glass hotel of the title. Vincent works there as a bartender, and Paul, who's attempting to become a musician but has had serious substance abuse problems, is just working as a cleaner in the hotel. And as far as I remember, his relationship to Vincent has remained secret from the management of the hotel. And then someone writes a message on the glass of the window of the bar from outside. And the message has been written with some sort of pen which has an acid which etches the glass, and so it can't simply be washed off. And the message is a question: why don't you eat broken glass? So for various reasons, Paul is suspected of having done this and he's quickly sacked. But it's not clear at that point what the message means or who it was meant for. It's only much later in the novel when we find out the answers to those questions, and it becomes fairly significant. But a short time later, the hotel is visited by its owner, who's a guy called Jonathan Alkaitis, I suppose how you pronounce it, A-L-K-A-I-T-I-S, Alkaitis. He's a wealthy investment counsellor, and for various reasons, he's charmed by Vincent, who is the bartender, and soon she becomes his mistress, though Alkaitis makes out that they're married to everyone he talks to. So Vincent then enters the world of the very rich, and at which point she describes it at one point as a separate country, a nation of its own, the nation of the rich. And however, it turns out that Alcatus's wealth is built on sand. The fantastically good rate of return he gives on the investments he manages is because the whole thing's a Ponzi scheme. That works by the returns on earlier investors are based on the money coming in from an increasing number of new investors. And the whole scheme is really based on that of the real-life Bernie Madoff. Eventually, of course, it all comes crashing down because you start to run out of new members coming in to investing the money. And I think also it's timed. The timing of the book is that it's just at the point where the global financial crisis happens. And so that, of course, triggers this whole scheme to fall apart. Now, the author, Emily St. John Mandel, disclaims the idea that Alcatus is meant to be based directly on Madoff personally, but she says that she was fascinated by how the people working for a character like that, the staff of such a business, knowing that it's all a fraud, convince themselves to keep turning up to work, knowing that eventually it's going to collapse. So we follow the fates of several of those members of staff after the collapse. And we also follow Alcatus himself, who gets convicted and is sentenced to 172 years in jail to be served sequentially. He's not getting out. So he becomes deluded and he imagines these various counterfactual timelines and he keeps having these visions of people he's talking to. And this is the ghost kind of thing, but talking to people he might have had relationships with in the past in a different timeline. What might have been, if you like. And so we, of course, also follow the fortunes of Vincent, who now is tossed out of her rich life and is spurned by the rich friends she's made while being Alcatus's mistress. And she drops out completely takes a complete right-hand turn in her life, and she becomes a cook on board a container ship. And it's from this ship that she eventually falls into the ocean, and how and why that happens takes some time to come out. So it's a really interesting book, really interesting characters. One of the reviewers of this book, I think in The Atlantic, says that the book's like a jigsaw puzzle which hasn't got the clues of the picture shown on the outside of the box. Somebody's lost the box and all you've got is the pieces. So it takes a while for you to piece together what it's all about and how these characters relate to each other. But it's a really cleverly woven narrative, and it's got several really interesting and complex characters. So I would say highly recommend it.
The concept of the Glass Hotel reminded me a bit of the Glass Church in Oscar and Lucinda.
Oh, yes.
The Peter Carey novel,
yes,
you recall,
that, yeah.
Floating down the river.
Yeah.
And them putting this church up in the middle of the Australian bush somewhere. It's a very strange sort of thing to be doing, and very strange thing to be doing with a hotel, making it all out of...
Well, it's not entirely out of glass, but there's lots of glass windows and things. But one of the interesting things, actually, since you mentioned the hotel again, is that one of the characters is the manager of the hotel. And after the global financial crisis and after Alcatus's empire collapses, no one wants to buy this hotel. And so it's just sitting there. And he actually asks permission to stay living in the hotel. He's the only person living in the hotel for years and years and years by himself because he just loves the hotel. See, it's one of the interesting characters.
Obsessions, isn't it? Aren't they wonderful? Well, the concept of the missing mother comes up in my book, next book as well. It's a new book by local author Jane Routley, and I hold it up to the camera for our listener, called Shadow in the Empire of Light. Jane Routley's been a writer in the fantasy field for the last... probably somewhere over 20-odd years, because she won a couple of Aurealis Awards for Best Fantasy Novel in the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
This is a new novel that doesn't fit into any of her previous series, and I must admit that I'm not familiar with her other work, so this is the first of hers that I've come across. It's a light fantasy, magical and mundane. So you've got some people with magic and some without. Anyway, to tell a bit about the story, it's based in the Empire of Light, which is an empire in some world, unnamed country, which is bordered by what are referred to as the Bone Mountains. Now, the people in the Empire of Light are a dark-skinned people who have a sort of like a genetic strain of magical abilities that run through. And the people with the magic end up becoming very high up in the hierarchy and generally start marrying into the Imperial family. Well, our main character of this particular book, Shine, is a member of that Imperial family. Unfortunately, she does not have any magical abilities. Now, the other thing about the countries outside or over to the west of the Bone Mountains is that they are inhabited by a light or white-skinned people. Now, there's not much interaction between those two countries, and the peasants of the Empire of Light believe that the ghosts, as they call them, that are from the other kingdom or the other country, are escapees from the land of the dead, and so will then kill them on sight whenever they see them. The Imperial family are trading with them because it seems like they have a lot more in the way of technology than the Empire of Light does, but they are also a bit more enlightened when it comes to politics, and the Empire of Light does not want to have the politics coming in from the outside, sullying the status quo and throwing everything up in the air. So anyway, Shine is a member of the Imperial family, as I said, but she's also a product of a union between her missing mother, so there's another missing mother here, and somebody from the other country. So she's a very much a light-skinned person called Ghosty by a lot of people, you know, an attempt to basically belittle her, which they do on a regular basis, and bully her as well. Now, she lives with her Aunt F on a farm called the Eyrie, or the house is called the Eyrie, but it's a big farm area. So she's become basically the farm manager of this whole place. And once a year, the Imperial family sort of turns up on the farm, because this farm is supplying them with a lot of the goods. And they turn up for a lot of basically rejoicing, feasting, and fornication. One of the things that seems to happen is that the magic seems to take away the fertility of the people that have it, and so they attempt to fornicate with fertile, non-magical people that are associated with the family, so one of the second, you know, third, fourth cousins or whatever, to try to basically keep the line going and to produce more magical relatives, if you like. You know, relatives with magical abilities, let us say. That's probably a better way of putting it. So anyways, basically, this novel is about the period when they all turn up for this festival of the blessing, or the blessing festival. Now, there's one cousin that turns up. He's actually a homosexual, so he's been ostracised by the family because he's not going to produce any heirs, and they don't like that. There's another one, Clea, that seems to have a very dark secret that she's trying to hide from everybody. So everything sort of starts off very quietly, and then all of the family descends on this house, and sort of mayhem ensues, and everything's sort of going along generally pretty well with a lot of hijinks all over the place, until one of the major aunts is found murdered. And then things start getting a little bit strange. And then you start finding out what the homosexual cousin's doing around the place, because nobody wants him there. And then you have to find out what Clea's doing there. There's a telepathic cat floating around in the middle of all this stuff.
Okay.
Now, it's a light fantasy told in a very sort of comic, whimsical sort of style. It's of its type. It's not bad. It's pretty good. I thought that, once it got past the problem of one or two chapters where she introduces like 20 or 30 new characters, and you go, what the hell? You just get all these characters come exploding onto the scene, and it gets a little bit hard to follow. Once you get past that, things start ticking along quite well. She's done well with this. I gave it 3.4 out of 5, and I think it's got plenty of room for sequels. Mm. I think she'll do fine with it. So. Mm.
Sounds interesting.
Not necessarily to my style, this one. I wouldn't be reading these all the time, but got sent this one for review, and so we are reviewing it here. But it, look, it's it was much more pleasant than I thought it was going to be, David.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, yes. Of course, we are open to people sending us books for review.
We are.
All right. I'm going to return to an author I talked about a couple of episodes ago, and that's Shirley Jackson, who was an American writer, I think mainly writing in the 60s, 70s, that sort of era. I may be wrong about that. I should actually look that up. Never mind. Anyway, I've sort of become really gripped by her. She's certainly one of the best writers I discovered last year. And so I'm sort of really following up, trying to read some of her other books. In fact, to the point where I've ordered the Library of America edition of the complete novels and stories, because the local library just doesn't have them all. So, anyway, the book I'm going to talk about today is The Haunting of Hill House. I talked a couple of episodes ago when I was talking about Shirley Jackson for the first time about her book We've Always Lived in the Castle. Now, I said that that was a book which seemed to me to mostly seem, from the outside, it looked to be like it was intended as being a lightly amusing gothic story, you know, kind of a slightly more serious Addams Family. But once I read it, I realized that that was nothing of the sort. There really aren't any supernatural elements at all in that book, but it's really just an intriguing look at a disturbed personality. And one thing I didn't say was that it's also a kind of perverted love story in a way, because it's the obsessive love of young Mary Cat for her older sister Constance, a love which may have led to the tragedy which killed most of the family. Anyway, so now I came to read this book, The Haunting of Hill House. So when I came to it, I was already, because of having read the other book, I was already prepared to consider that it wasn't what it seemed on the surface. So on a superficial look, you sort of look at the cover and get the sort of general idea of what the book's supposed to be about. You'd think it was going to be a classic horror tale set in a haunted house. But isn't that at all? It turns out to be yet another study of a disturbed personality. And it's a love story. Bear with me here. So, quick summary of the story. Dr. John Montague is a paranormal researcher. He's a real academic, a real scientist interested in documenting apparently supernatural events. And he's heard about strange happenings in a place called Hill House. So he decides to rent it for a few months and actually live there in order to study the events. And he makes a call for volunteers to join him there. But in the end, only a few people agree to do so. Two women. One is Eleanor Vance, and the other is called Theodora. I don't think we ever get her surname. So Eleanor and Theodora. And they're joined by Luke Sanderson, who's a young man who's one of the owners of the place, having inherited a share in the property from his parents. So all these people arrive individually at Hill House, but Eleanor is there the first. And it's mostly Eleanor whose point of view we share. She's certainly the key to the whole book. So, yes, there's this creepy old house, Hill House, which has had tragedies all happen in it, more than one tragedy happen inside it. And, yes, there are spooky areas in the house, like this freezing cold area at the entrance to the children's nursery. Yes, the old couple who act as the custodian cook seem very odd and very creepy. And, yes, long ago, a young woman hung herself in the library tower. And yes, while the group are staying at the house, very scary things happen, mostly overnight. None of these things make it a horror story, in my view. This is my personal view. I think it's pretty clearly a tragic love story. And Eleanor is one of the lovers. The other lover is the house itself. So consider these things. The title of the book, The Haunting of Hill House. It's not the haunting at Hill House. It almost appears that it's the house itself which is being haunted by the people staying there, or by one of them at least. So let's consider the first couple of sentences of the book. So this is the first paragraph, or first couple of sentences out of the first paragraph. No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. Apart from what I think is the masterful quality of the writing there, the phrase Hill House, not sane, makes it obvious to me, at least, that we're supposed to consider the house as a character, a mentally disturbed character. But Eleanor, we slowly discovered, also has a disturbed personality. She's spent decades looking after her mother in her declining years, and so she's been sort of locked away, looking after her mother, unable to form relationships with men or with anybody else, really. unlike her younger sister who's gone off and got married. But now her mother has died recently, and Elnor has got this desperate need to be wanted by someone, to be needed by someone. And when she arrives at Hill House, she finds an entity which does need her. It's the house. But on the way there, she's driving there. She takes quite a while to drive there. She's had the tune of a song running in her head, but she can't identify it or recall the words until she arrives at the actual entrance of Hill House. And here's another quote. "It was an act of moral strength to lift her foot and set it on the bottom step, and she thought that her deep unwillingness to touch Hill House for the first time came directly from the vivid feeling that it was waiting for her, evil but patient. Journeys end in lovers' meeting," she thought, remembering her song at last. Sort of this is the key phrase out of the song, "Journeys end in lovers' meeting," which she repeats a number of times through the book. It turns out this is a song out of Shakespeare. It's out of, I think it's out of Twelfth Night. So this is the Shakespeare quote. I'm doing a lot of quoting today. "Oh, stay and hear your true love's coming that can sing both high and low. Trip no further, pretty sweeting. Journeys end in lovers' meeting. Every wise man's son doth know." And later, when spooky things start happening overnight, one of the things that happens as part of these spooky things is there are messages scrawled on the wall, on walls in the house, throughout the house. Initially in chalk, but later there's an instance where it's actually written up in blood in someone's room, in Theodora's room, actually. And the message is, "Help, Eleanor, come home, Eleanor." So it's the house calling to her. Eventually, Eleanor's disturbed state of mind and her increasing attachment to the house lead the other people there to try to force her to leave. You know, they're really worried about what it's doing to her, and they try to force her to leave and return to her own home, where we eventually discover that she's had a miserable existence because she's actually just sleeping on a trundle bed in her sister's spare room. And as the book closes, Eleanor, who's forced away from the house, takes a dramatic step, which I won't reveal, but you can imagine that this means that she will, in fact, stay forever at Hill House. It's all just brilliant stuff. So I've got to read the rest of Jackson's novels and her short stories. She wrote a lot of short stories. So, she's a real discovery for me. Terrific, terrific writer. Terrific stuff.
Sounds like you have to pay attention to the small bits.
Oh, yeah.
There's little clues around all over the place as long as you read it the right way. But if you skip through them and go in with a preconceived idea that you're going to end up getting a preconceived conclusion, which isn't the one that is actually the one that the writer wants you to get, or...
Well, at least I think that's what I'm... Maybe I haven't got it right, but that's the way it appears to me.
No. Maybe, well, I think you probably have by the sounds of things. I mean, Shirley Jackson's somebody I know of, but I haven't read anything by. But as you say, when you talk about The Haunting and Hill House, you sort of think, okay, this is something like... The Shining or any of those Stephen King books about houses that are malevolent and are going to take over. But it isn't necessarily the case.
No.
If that happens.
Yeah. Well, she predates Stephen King, of course.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't be... King would be very familiar with her work. And he's very respectful of the people that have gone before him, and he's read widely in the field. And it would be interesting to go back and have a look at some of his books like Dance Macabre that he wrote 20, 30 years ago to see what he actually says about Shirley Jackson. I must go and have a look at that for you, David. It's up here somewhere. I don't know where. It's just... Anyway.
Yeah. Just quickly looking at Wikipedia, she died in 1965, so she was writing during the 50s and 60s.
Yeah,
basically.
Well, there's a major award in the field named after the Shirley Jackson Award, and I believe I've read some of the works that have won that award, and they are very interesting stuff, mainly psychological studies. So they're very very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to talk about something which is just slightly to the left of that.
Okay.
There's a couple of novellas that I want to have a talk about. As you recall, novellas are those shorter novels or shorter stories, stories that are shorter than novels that fit between 17,500 words and 40,000 words. At least that's the definition for the Hugo's and Nebula Awards. And so that's what we're talking about here. These are about 80 pages each, so that gives you an idea of the length. So put two of them together, 160. So that's a short novel, but When we were growing up, David, 160, 192 pages, standard novel length. Now it's like 10,000 pages and you're barely getting started.
Yeah, that's right. Let alone 9 volumes.
Or 9 volumes, yeah. 900,000 words, by God. This particular series, or because there's only two of them, sequence if you like, is called the Greenwood Duology. I haven't ever seen the word duology used before. No. It's always trilogy or something, but duology. The two that I'm dealing with or looking at here are Silver in the Wood and Drowned Country by Emily Tesh. Now, Silver in the Wood is important. That was her very first novella, and it won the World Fantasy Award for Best Novella in 2020. So it was written in 2019. Drowned Country was written in 2020. So this is part of my reading for possible novellas that are going to appear on awards for later. And given that one of them was an award winner, the previous one, and this being the sequel to it, chances are people start looking at you if you win an award straight away. Now, anyway, so this is, I'll start with Silver in the Wood. It features, first off, a gentleman by the name of Tobias Finch. Now, he's a 400-year-old green man living in and protecting the Green Hollow Wood. So this is that the green man idea of being completely associated with nature. Nature's looking after him. He's looking after nature. Now, Tobias Finch meets and befriends the new owner of the local manor house, Henry Silver. So there's your Silver in the Wood. And his whole life begins to change, basically. There are other forces in the wood, other malevolent forces, one of which is the Lord of Summer, who we don't really know who he is, but he is a very malevolent force. And he takes a shine to Silver and takes him out of this world. Now, Finch is also interested in Silver, and along with the formidable and knowing Mrs. Silver, that's Henry's mother, he sets off to undertake to bring Silver out of the clutches of the Lord of Summer and back into the real world. This is really well done, I thought. This is a classic woodland British traditional story. Touches of a little bit of Tolkien, but a lot of Robert Holdstock in this. The author shows a lot of talent, and I was quite taken with this. Gave 3.8 out of 5. I thought it was a good example of its particular type. So when I found out that there was a sequel, I was quite happy to read that. This is called Drowned Country. It takes place 2 years after the events of the previous one, Silver in the Wood. At this time, Henry Silver's still living in the manor house. They've still got the wood, although Tobias Finch has left. And here, there's nobody around other than Henry, and he's allowed basically the forest to overtake the house, if you like, in the 2 years. Shortly after the novel starts, Henry's mother turns up and says, I need your help to try and find this particular young girl that's gone missing. Her parents are looking for her. They want to bring her back. Can't Tobias do this? Because Henry knows that Tobias by this stage has gone and worked for his mother. No, I need you specifically. Doesn't know why until he turns up and finds out that really they think that Maud Livingston, the name of the girl that's gone missing, has been taken by a 900-year-old vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And normally the vampire is after young men. And so Henry's mother wants to use Henry as bait to bring the vampire out.
Okay.
Well, as it happens, they find out what's happened to the vampire, and Maud Livingston has a lot more talent for evasion and getting around things than they really knew. And they find out that, because I'm not giving too much of this away, she's actually defeated the vampire, chopped its head off, chopped its hand off, and powdered the hand, and is going to use it as a means of being able to enter Fairyland, because what she really wants is to get to Fairyland. And what she says that she's done in the past, and they suddenly realise, is she's met both Henry Silver and Tobias Finch before, because she followed a fairy into Finch's wood. Another very interesting way of doing things, interesting way that Fairyland is handled here. This is not your little fairies floating around in the woods sort of stuff. These fairies have been around for a long period of time and they're not happy. They are not happy at all. She's written another winner here. I think that these are excellent pieces of work. If you're interested in this sort of style, or this British woodland style of fantasy. And I've just been reading recently about the work of a woman from Canada who's talking about the idea that all trees in those ancient forests are all connected by fungi underground, and they pass information, hormones and carbon and water backwards and forwards between each other to make sure that the whole of the place is sustained and kept viable. It's a very interesting concept, and you can now start to see where, if you take that as the scientific side of things, how woods are all basically interconnected. And it was just a very good juxtaposition of having that sort of information when I was reading these particular novellas. Mm. They're good. Emily Tesh is an excellent writer, worthwhile following and watching. And I think she's going to do some better work. Or not, I shouldn't say better work, because this stuff's pretty good. But I think she'll be doing more work on a longer length later on. As long as it doesn't go to 600 pages, I'll be happy. If you can keep it down to, you know, good chunky 300, I'll be there. And I'll actually be reading it.
There we go. All right, that sounds good. Now, I've been realising this episode has got a theme running through it, and that's the theme of it's a very wet episode. There's lots of water and there's lots of people getting drowned.
There is lots of it, yes.
Because yours was it the drowned land?
Drowned country. Yep.
The drowned country.
Yes,
yeah,
there's a lot of things being drowned over long periods of time.
The next one I'm going to talk with, the last one I'm going to talk about is certainly on the same theme. Because this is called The Sunken Land Has Begun to Rise Again by M. John Harrison. And I've talked a little bit about it pretty incoherently so far on the podcast. So, but now I'm going to do it seriously. And in fact, later on in the episode, I'm going to be talking to friend of the podcast, academic Lucy Sussex, about this particular book. And so we'll have a bit more of a chat about it. But at least I think I won't talk too much about it because there is that interview coming up. But I will at least try to give a general outline of it before we get into that interview. And it's really hard to know how to begin to describe or discuss this book. I think I've sort of indicated that before. It's one of my best books of last year for sure. And in fact, I read it twice. I read it once last year and once at the beginning of this year because I enjoyed it so much and I really wanted to figure out what was going on. But even after reading it a couple of times, there's a lot in it which remains baffling after a second read. And I think that's by design. All right, so here's the basics. It's a novel set in modern-day England with two primary characters who are fairly ordinary middle-aged people. And each of them is going through a kind of crisis or inflection point in their life. So the first character is Alex Shaw, who's in his 50s, and he's going through what he calls a rough patch. He's kind of unemployed, and he's living in a cheap rented room in suburban London. But he strikes up a relationship with a young, well, not a young woman, she's a woman in her 40s, or just turned 40, a woman called Victoria, who announces that she works in a morgue and that she saw her first corpse at the age of 14. It's not really clear whether that's true or whether it's just a conversational ploy to get started in a conversation. But anyway, these are the two people who we follow through the book. And this sort of this relationship between the two characters is really pretty lukewarm. It's kind of on again, off again. They drop in and out of contact. So Victoria moves out of her suburban house near London to go and renovate her mother's house. Her mother's died in Shropshire on the banks of the Severn River. Shaw's mother, by contrast, is still alive in a nursing home, and she's got some sort of dementia which makes her treat Shaw always with this continual scorn, and she always fails to remember his name or calls him something different. Apparently she has many children, and so his visits to her are these really quite comic records of deep frustration. So in that respect, it's quite funny. But then extraordinary things begin to occur to both of these people. And throughout the book, we talked about this theme of drowning and wetness. Throughout this book, we're constantly made aware of the strong and increasing presence of water. And the rivers Thames and Severn, frequent downpours of rain, ponds and gardens flood, water's everywhere. It's not so much the sunken land starting to rise as the waters rising and bringing with them strange things, such as there are reports of embryonic forms floating in toilet bowls, shadowy pale people seen running and diving into the rivers at night, greenish body parts washed up on the shore. One night shore meets a man called Tim, who's scooping water from a pool. He's near a park somewhere. He's scooping water from a pool into bottles. And Tim offers him a job, which involves working in an office on a moored barge. And also, he seems to involve making frequent trips with Tim to various parts of the country to deliver mysterious boxes, which sometimes contain bottles of this murky water and sometimes books titled The Journey of Our Genes. So he seems to be running this conspiracy theory website, which, among other things, is obsessed with the aquatic theory of human evolution, which proposes that humans passed through a phase where they lived largely in the water like seals. So, you know, are there still such humans? Are they returning? Anyway. And meanwhile, Victoria's finding her neighbours in Shropshire very odd, and she keeps emailing Shaw about her experiences. Why does almost everyone who Victoria meets keep wanting to foist a copy of Charles Kingsley's book, The Water Babies, onto her? Anyway, I won't go into any more detail because, as I say, I'm going to be talking to Lucy about this very shortly. But it's a really, really interesting book, which it has many baffling things about it, but I think it's almost by design. Lucy, as you'll hear, sort of sees it in it a metaphor of the state of pre-Brexit Britain. And there's a lot in that, I think, as an idea. Anyway, so that's as much as I'll say now, and I might move on to the interview with Lucy.
I was going to say, when did you first become aware of Mike Harrison?
Okay, well, this is the first book of his I read, and the only reason I read it at all was that Perry sent me an article about it, which was when it had just won a prize. Is it the Goldsmith Prize that it won?
Yes, for fiction that breaks the mould, and the previous winner was Lucy Ellman's Ducks Newburyport, which is a brick of a book in entirely one sentence about the experience, about the stream of consciousness of an American housewife, and I couldn't get very far into it.
Oh, okay, no. Whereas this one, I thought was very engaging. It sort of got me in right from the start, even though it's just talking about two who fairly ordinary people when you begin, sort of middle-aged people. But then it takes you in some very strange directions.
Yeah, he knows his, unlike, I mean, I don't want to be too rude about Ducks Newburyport because I do know people who like it, but he knows his way around narrative, and I think he's written a few space operas.
Okay.
With a kind of weird twist. I remember an extract from one in New Worlds where they were all named after decadent, where the spaceships were all named after decadent or aesthetic images. So like the green carnation. So he's got a very strange sensibility. But this one has a narrative and it draws you in. He really knows what he's doing. And so it begins with, during his 50s, Shaw went through a rough patch.
Yes.
And that shouldn't be an enticing beginning, and yet you're hooked about halfway down the page. And a different writer would have started with Victoria's line on that same page. I'm someone who saw her first corpse when she was 14.
Yes.
But he does this kind of slow build-up. And I think that's pretty much how this book goes. It's slow, but you can't, it's unputdownable, and it's not about a madcap rush of incidents, but it's, I think it's actually to do with his sentences.
Yeah, it's really well written in that sense, but as you say, it's very slow. For a fair proportion of the book, well, maybe the first third of the book, nothing really weird starts happening, or the things that are weird you don't sort of see as weird at the time. It's just as they develop. Like when Shaw gets involved with Tim, he sort of meets this guy who's sort of digging a hole in a park and scooping water out of the pool into these bottles, and which is kind of weird, but, you know, okay, it's kind of strange guy. And then Tim offers him a job, and it's only really when you get into the job that things really start to turn odd. And it's the same with Victoria. Victoria has decided that she wants to go and renovate her mother's house. Her mother's died, And so she goes to this place in Shropshire and starts to sort of get this house back into some sort of order for her to live in. But it's only when you start to find out how odd the neighbours are and the strange ways they react to things that you start to think, well, yeah, something going on here. What is it that's going on? And in fact, really, that's the whole thrust of the book is what the heck is going on by the time you get to the end.
One thing about the book is it's a pretty unsurpassable picture of Britain on the brink of Brexit
Yes.
and the lingering past glories, the sort of covert or overt xenophobia, the sense of that things are declining and it's no longer Great Britain. It's and that's, I think, linked to the urtext. Oh, no, urtext isn't quite the right word. The metafiction behind this book is fiction about fiction. That's the Water Babies, which everybody, for some reason, is reading. And people are passing copies to and fro, which is odd for a 19th century children's book that is not common parlance. But I think it actually links very closely to the theme of the book. And I'll tell you why I think that is, in that I had read The Water Babies. I remember Mrs. Do As You
Do
Will Be Done By.
as you would be done by, yes.
And I remember that the book, even as a kid, I noticed that the book was pretty sadistic. One of the things I didn't know about it was that Charles Kingsley, the author, who was a very muscular Christian and a rather strange man, he. It's a book about a chimney sweep who's cruelly treated and falls into water and turns into a water baby and is
But
rejuvenated.
he
Yeah,
drowns and
drowns.
turns into a water baby,
That's
which
it,
I think is
yeah.
significant, yeah.
But what I didn't know about the book was that it was written in response to to Darwinism, of which Kingsley was a supporter, unlike many muscular Christians of the time. He thought, and this was, so it's a book actually about evolution, so that Tom evolves into a being that can survive underwater. And so it's a kind of a satire of, well, there's some satirical element, but it's about evolution. And my feeling is that this is carried over into Harrison's book in this very overt motif, but it's, but in Harrison's book, it's more a satire of devolution, the devolving of Britain.
That makes sense. But there is this sense, as you say, that there's something rotten in the state of Britain, and that the rot is the rot is coming up from below. It's like rising damp. And there's so much water in this story. You know, all these all th this drenching rain and things flooding and pools of water forming places and strange things popping arriving in the water. As you say, there's this kind of weird feeling of rot at the core. And it's the same with Victoria's house, really. There's a rot at the core of her house, and the cellar's got problems, and there's rising damp, and there's all these really quite nice metaphors throughout it, I think.
I think also that he's writing about global warming, rising water, and that's about the one evidence of climate change I can find in the book. But it reads like a realist book, but it's not. It's on the edge. It's what they call slipstream work, that is, which was a term that's never really caught on except among science fiction people. But it's about work that's on the borderland between realist, between the mainstream and the genre fiction. And I'd say that this is, it's a crossover book. And I made the point on Facebook that while genre writers complain bitterly about writers in the mainstream taking the motifs and being successful with it and thinking they've invented cli-fi, which is a term I hate.
Hate
But
horrible stuff, yes.
he's gone in the opposite direction and he's actually invaded the mainstream and done it in such a superlative fashion through the strength of its language that he's actually shown that he does it better. The analogy I might make is with another book from America, Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad.
Oh, yes, yes, another book I've read.
Which is, in some respects, it has an extremely silly premise that yes. the Underground Railroad really was an underground railroad. But because it's writing, because he introduces this quite outlandish metaphor, it kind of acts to release him in other areas. So yes. So he makes, I think, an interesting point, and I'd say possibly he's read Solzhenitsyn in that every plantation was a separate gulag, and that the underground, so he introduces a different form of slavery and its atrocities, but with the metaphor of the Underground Railroad, so that it's this edge of strangeness that puts the book in a different character.
Yeah.
And so Harrison, who's, you know, pretty much a past master of this, is introducing this really strange metaphor. Is are sea creatures really arising with the from the deep?
Mm.
And even worse, are they indistinguishable from human beings?
Yes.
I mean, are human beings morphing into these creatures?
Yes.
And that's the metaphor which disrupts what otherwise would be a very acute and in fact quite scathing view of Brexit Britain. So it's a superb piece of realism, but it's propelled but it's pushed into another area by this very disturbing horror element, which yes. is maintained throughout.
Yes. I mean, one of the most horrible parts of the book, I think, is that bit where they visit Helen's house and she's got this pool outside. And in this pool, this whole bunch of these guys that Shaw's with Tim and so on, and there's this sort of splashing in this pool, and something comes out of the pool, and they wrap it in a tarpaulin and bundle it away in the back of this taxi.
Yeah.
And there's kind of this greenish hand, you know, dangling out of it.
Yeah.
What is going on? So is this underground stuff generating these people? You know, is this underground, this underground land, the sunken land, is that rising in the form of these people? But yeah, I love that sort of stuff. It's really very clever, and it really pulls you in.
Yeah, and then, I mean, it's very funny in places.
Oh, it's a very funny book, yes.
Yeah, but really, really dark.
Oh, yeah.
I think one of the interesting parts is that the funniest bit for me is that the only people who really know what's going on are the conspiracy theorists, but yes. nobody takes them seriously.
That's right, exactly right.
That's good. But I think somebody made a very interesting comparison when I was looking at the critical reception, and it said he wrote the best sentences in English since P.G. Woodhouse.
Yeah.
And I thought, yes, but P.G. Woodhouse is very comforting and they're pure escapist enjoyment, unless he's deciding to have a go at Sir Oswald Mosley, which he does very successfully. But just some of these sentences here, you know, from Shaw and Victoria, they met a couple more times, went to bed, argued back and forth in the way people do when they're just slightly more than attracted to one another.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting phrase. It's got a lot of acuity to it. And then anybody else couldn't get away with this amount of metaphors. He redirected himself like a parcel.
Yes, yes.
Or on the same page, life drew itself closed as suddenly as cheap curtains. Mm. And so it's poetry, but it's poetry of the mundane.
Mm.
And it's seeing, you know, it's a real linguistic facility here.
Mm.
And I must admit, while I thought, I have read some Harrison before, but it went in one eye and out the other.
Okay.
So it just didn't. But this one, you know, God, he's 75. It took him all this time to get to this.
No, exactly. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. I think he's had success within genre. He won a Tiptree Award.
Hmm.
And he went to Wiscon, and the wonderful description of him after he'd won his award, you get a crown. And so here, there he was with his crown on, looking like Oberon, the king of the fairies, and this long white hair.
Yes.
And I said, as the evening went on, he'd had a few drinks. He just looked like the increasingly debauched king of fairyland.
That sounds wonderful. That's great. Yeah, I mean, I liked the book so much that I read it twice within, I think, a month and a half. I mean, I did that as much as anything so I could talk sensibly about it. But it really is a book where you sort of have to go back and, you know, try to figure out what he's telling you. And so I thought that was an interesting aspect of it. The other thing I thought was interesting is the number of references he makes to not only to other books. There's a link definitely to Pincher Martin, William Golding's book, which
that's right,
which
he's already drowned.
Which gets mentioned several times. Yeah, which is a book in which you find at the end that the narrator is actually drowned. But the other thing is all the paintings he talks about. I don't know whether you picked that up, where he keeps talking about various paintings that he's got up as posters, or they're hung as paintings in his mother's aged care facility, or he's got up on his wall as paintings.
Mm.
And it's actually worth looking up those paintings on Wikipedia and actually having a look at them, because they all have this same sort of disturbing feel about them of things happening in the water or at the edge of water, which so really does throw light on all the rest of what he's saying. I think it's well worth doing that.
Yeah, well, when I wrote this up on Facebook, it was under an occasional series I have called Writers Who Really Know What They're Doing, and I'd put him in that category very firmly.
Yeah.
Some respect, you could say he owns the mainstream. He just shows that it just looks so effortless.
Yes.
And it's such a performance.
Mm.
But, yeah, I dipped in it. I don't very rarely, it's very rarely that I look at a book twice, and sometimes when I do that, I do it. I want to see how they've done it.
Mm.
And sometimes I get a big disappointment when I'm reading it again. Mm. But this one, yeah, you'd notice stuff you hadn't before and the foregrounding of this.
Mm.
And then you think, okay, there's a lot of Ballardian sort of enemy or people talking at cross purposes, but it all makes perfect sense in the end, even though it's, even then, the mystery is never quite revealed. But
oh, no,
suspension of disbelief. But there it goes.
Yeah, I think that's part of what he's aiming for. Sometimes things are inexplicable, or that from various points of view, you may never understand what's going on. Even though the other people, as you say, the conspiracists, seem to have a better idea of what's going on than either Victoria or Shaw, but. So they're kind of bewildered at the end of the book. In fact, Victoria steps out of the book towards the end. But I can't talk as knowledgeably as you about it. But I just thought it was a great book, great read.
Yeah, I thought it was extremely interesting and a pretty bravura performance. And you know, just somebody who was totally in control, totally at home with the material, and. It's not necessarily a pleasant experience, but it's a very edifying one. And something interesting as I was just looking around on the net. This is bizarre. There's a copy in the Parliamentary Library of Australia.
Okay.
I can't imagine who would have ordered it for the library and who in Parliament would read it. But
Well, it'd be interesting to know. Yeah, don't know.
Oh, well, I guess there's science fiction fans in the oddest of places.
Well, that's very true. That's very true. I saw that, this is an aside, but I saw that on Barack Obama's best books of 2020, the latest Kim Stanley Robinson was one of his best books of 2020. So I have yet to read that, but I thought it was interesting that he had it on his list.
Well, Perry's read it. I haven't. Various people spoke very highly of it. I mean, Stan's been writing lots of. He's been on the theme of climate change but this is maybe the book that gets the most attention. If you get a recommendation from Barack, you have a big readership.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. We're worth following up his lists, I find. So, yeah, it's good.
Unlike Oprah Winfrey, who I always find far too sentimental.
No, no, That's right. No, it's good. Yeah, there's some very good books on his list, several of which I actually did read last year, so I'm not too far behind, I guess. Yeah. So, what more is there to say about Harrison's book? The title, by the way, is actually from a quote from something by Charles Kingsley himself, the guy who wrote The Water Babies. So the title is to do with something about being in a quarry, I think, and he's seeing the shape of the land or the shape of the strata in the quarry, and he's talking about the sunken land rising again.
There's also an Australian connection that's interesting in that his brother Henry Kingsley came out to Australia and wrote a novel, Geoffrey Hamlin, which was for years thought to be the best Australian novel, but then which lasted for about 15 or so years, but it's still on the syllabus of if what's left of Australian literature's university teaching in this country. It's still very much on the syllabus. It's quite a book, quite it's quite a reasonable book for its time, but it's not quite as disturbing as The Water Babies.
No, that's right. All right. I think we've probably said enough about
Okay,
Harrison's
thank
book,
you.
don't you think? Yeah.
I
Thank you
think
for, thank
so.
you very
We
much for
cover
that.
that. Thank you.
And yeah, we must do this again on for some other books.
Excellent.
Thanks for that, Lucy. That was a very interesting talk.
So, have you come out of that thinking that you understand what it's about now, David? I know that you've told me a couple of times that you really don't understand it terribly well.
I don't think I certainly don't understand the details of what's going on, but there's the general impression of this kind of rot at the heart of Britain, perhaps the heart of the world, but certainly the heart of Britain. And these things are appearing, and no one really has much of an idea what's going on. They're bewildered. There's this sort of general bewilderment going on. But the only people who really understand what's going on, it appears, are the conspiracy theorists.
All
They've
right.
got the best idea. So it's one of those books. It's hard to describe, but it's actually a really engaging book. You pick it up and you just don't stop reading it until you get to the end. I would say it's highly recommended.
Okay.
Yeah.
I shall put it on the list, the very,
Indeed.
very long list.
I put it down as a nomination for the Hugo, but it won't get on the Hugo list, I shouldn't think.
Who
We'll
knows?
see.
Who
We'll
knows?
see.
All right, David, I think does that bring us to the end of this particular episode?
I
Quite a
think it
long one,
probably does. I've been talking for quite a while.
but we have had a bit to talk about, and we've read a bit. Next time, we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll be talking about crime fiction next time. We've got
Indeed.
a bit of that we'd like to talk about that we've read. Some old, some new, some Australian, some non-Australian. Hopefully that will be a good episode as well.
Indeed.
Thanks, David. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. Thanks, Perry, and we'll see you then.